She turned to him in the ray of a street lamp, raising and holding her face in full light for a silent, deliberate moment, as if in answer and confirmation of his thought. He closed his eyes. "Oh, God. Dagny," he whispered. They walked on in silence. "He's gone by now, isn't he?" he asked. "From the Taggart terminal, I mean." "Eddie," she said, her voice suddenly grim, "if you value his life, don't ever ask that question. You don't want them to find him, do you? Don't give them any leads. Don't ever breathe a word to anyone about having known him. Don't try to find out whether he's still working in the terminal."
"You don't mean that he's still there?"
"I don't know. I know only that he might be."
"Now?"
"Yes."
"Still?"
"Yes, keep quiet about it if you don't want to destroy him."
"I think he's gone. He won't be back. I haven't seen him since."
"Since?"
"Since when?" she asked sharply. "The end of May. The night when you left for Utah, remember?"
He paused as the memory of that night's encounter and the full understanding of its meaning struck him together. He said with effort,
"I saw him that night. Not since. I've waited for him in the cafeteria. He never came back."
"I don't think he'll let you see him now. He'll keep out of your way, but don't look for him. Don't inquire."
"It's funny. I don't even know what name he used. It was Johnny something, or it was John Galt," she said with a faint, mirthless chuckle.
"Don't look at the terminal payroll. The name is still there."
"Just like that? All these years?"
"For 12 years.
Just like that. And it's still there now?"
"Yes."
After a moment, he said, "It proves nothing, I know. The personnel office hasn't taken a single name off the payroll list since Directive 10-289. If a man quits, they give his name and job to a starving friend of their own rather than report it to the Unification Board."
"Don't question the personnel office or anyone. Don't call attention to his name. If you or I make any inquiries about him, somebody might begin to wonder. Don't look for him. Don't make any move in his direction. And if you ever catch sight of him by chance, act as if you didn't know him."
He nodded. After a while, he said, his voice tense and low, "I wouldn't turn him over to them. Not even to save the railroad."
"Eddie?"
"Yes."
"If you ever catch sight of him, tell me."
He nodded.
2 blocks later, he asked quietly,
"You're going to quit one of these days and vanish, aren't you?"
"Why do you say that?"
It was almost a cry. "Aren't you?"
She did not answer at once. When she did, the sound of despair was present in her voice, only in the form of too tight a monotone.
"Eddie, if I quit, what would happen to the Taggart trains?" "There would be no Taggart trains within a week, maybe less."
"There will be no Looter's government within 10 days. Then men like Cuffy Meggs will devour the last of our rails and engines. Should I lose the battle by failing to wait one more moment? How can I let it go? Taggart Transcontinental, Eddie. Go forever, when one last effort can still keep it in existence. If I've stood things this long, I can stand them a little longer. Just a little longer. I'm not helping the Looters. Nothing can help them now."
"What are they going to do?"
"I don't know. What can they do? They're finished."
"I suppose so."
"Didn't you see them? They're miserable, panic-stricken rats running for their lives."
"Does it mean anything to them?"
"What?"
"Their lives."
"They're still struggling, aren't they? But they're through, and they know it."
"Have they ever acted on what they know?"
"They'll have to. They'll give up. It won't be long. And we'll be here to save whatever's left."
"Mr. Thompson wishes it to be known," said official broadcasts on the morning of November 23rd, "that there is no cause for alarm. He urges the public not to draw any hasty conclusions. We must preserve our discipline, our morale, our unity, and our sense of broad-minded tolerance. The unconventional speech, which some of you might have heard on the radio last night, was a thought-provoking contribution to our pool of ideas on world problems.
we must consider it soberly, avoiding the extremes of total condemnation or of reckless agreement. We must regard it as one viewpoint out of many in our democratic forum of public opinion, which, as last night has proved, is open to all. The truth, says Mr. Thompson, has many facets. We must remain impartial.
They're silent, wrote Chick Morrison as a summary of its content across the report from one of the field agents he had sent out on a mission entitled Public Pulse Taking.
They're silent, he wrote across the next report, then across another and another.
Silence, he wrote with a frown of uneasiness, summing up his report to Mr. Thompson.
People seem to be silent.
The flames that went up to the sky of a winter night and devoured a home in Wyoming were not seen by the people of Kansas, who watched a trembling red glow on the prairie horizon made by the flames that went up to devour a farm, and the glow was not reflected by the windows of a street in Pennsylvania, where the twisting red tongues were reflections of the flames that went up to devour a factory. Nobody mentioned next morning that those flames had not been set off by chance, and that the owners of the three places had vanished. Neighbors observed it without comment, and without astonishment. A few homes were found abandoned in random corners across the nation, some left locked, shuttered, and empty, others open and gutted of all movable goods. But people watched it in silence, and through the snowdrifts of untended streets and the haze of pre-morning darkness, went on trudging to their jobs, a little slower than usual. Then, on November 27th, a speaker at a political meeting in Cleveland was beaten up and had to escape by scurrying down dark alleys. His silent audience had come to sudden life when he had shouted that the cause of all their troubles was their selfish concern with their own troubles. On the morning of November 29th, the workers of a shoe factory in Massachusetts were astonished on entering their workshop to find that the foreman was late. But they went to their usual posts and went on with their habitual routine, pulling levers, pressing buttons, feeding leather into automatic cutters, piling boxes on a moving belt, wondering as the hours went by why they did not catch sight of the foreman, or the superintendent, or the general manager, or the company president. It was noon before they discovered that the front offices of the plant were empty.
"You goddamn cannibals!"
screamed a woman in the midst of a crowded movie theater, breaking into sudden hysterical sobs. And the audience showed no sign of astonishment, as if she were screaming for them all.
"There is no cause for alarm," said official broadcasts on December 5th. "Mr. Thompson wishes it to be known that he is willing to negotiate with John Galt for the purpose of devising ways and means to achieve a speedy solution of our problems. Mr. Thompson urges the people to be patient. We must not worry. We must not doubt. We must not lose heart."
The attendants of a hospital in Illinois showed no astonishment when a man was brought in, beaten up by his elder brother, who had supported him all his life. The younger man had screamed at the elder, accusing him of selfishness and greed, just as the attendants of a hospital in New York City showed no astonishment at the case of a woman who came in with a fractured jaw. She had been slapped in the face by a total stranger, who had heard her ordering her 5-year-old son to give his best toy to the children of neighbors. Chick Morrison attempted a whistle-stop tour to buttress the country's morale by speeches on self-sacrifice for the general welfare. He was stoned at the first of his stops and had to return to Washington. Nobody had ever granted them the title of the better men, or granting it had paused to grasp that title's meaning. But everybody knew, each in his own community, neighborhood, office, or shop, and in his own unidentified terms, who would be the men that would now fail to appear at their posts on some coming morning, and would silently vanish in search of unknown frontiers? The men whose faces were tighter than the faces around them, whose eyes were more direct, whose energy was more conscientiously enduring. The men who were now slipping away one by one from every corner of the country. Of the country which was now like the descendant of what had once been regal glory, prostrated by the scourge of hemophilia, losing the best of its blood from a wound not to be healed.
"But we're willing to negotiate," yelled Mr. Thompson to his assistants, ordering the special announcement to be repeated by all radio stations 3 times a day. "We're willing to negotiate. He'll hear it. He'll answer."
Special listeners were ordered to keep watch day and night at radio receivers tuned to every known frequency of sound, waiting for an answer from an unknown transmitter. There was no answer.